Ministry folks, we'll begin our session. This is Mark Larson on nature photography. And any text references that I make today is to John Shaw's Nature Photographer's Complete Guide to the Professional Field Techniques. And anyone who's still interested, I think there's at least three copies left. People keep saying $18 or whatever is expensive, but for a book this quality in terms of the reproduction and also just the general utility, it's a bargain. So I recommend it to anyone who needs something to read. We're going to talk today about composition. And as you might have anticipated, I'm starting with the point of view that composition is a very personal, individual idea that each of us has about how an image should be made. But it plays an important role with at least two other elements. Style that you personally develop, use with your photography, and the cropping that you do with your photography. Cropping refers to where the edges of this approximately 3x5 frame goes. What's interesting, right, is after you start doing a little bit of photography, what happens to your brain and your eye? Cropping is almost the easiest part, because all of a sudden you start thinking like you're looking through a viewfinder. Style to me also becomes easy once you give away the idea that you have to be a Galen Rowell or Ansel Adams or Gordon White or Imogen Cunningham, and I don't care what kind of artist or painter you are. Once you stop trying to be somebody, your style will come out. Composition, though, ultimately becomes a fairly complex process if you're into heavy analysis of composition. I prefer, on the other hand, let nature compose scenes for me. I look carefully around me. I stop, I walk slowly, and generally nature has provided the composition for me. What is left for me to do as a photographer is to be able to control my light meter, my lenses, and the time of day, the type of light that's there. And of course, he was just describing getting up at 6:50 this morning for early sunlight on the mountains to the west, and that's the type of control I'm talking about. Being able to get up early in the morning, stay out after supper, dinner at night. It's amazing, when I go to Yellowstone, I always go out after 6 p.m. in the summertime, because nobody's there. The animals come out, the light gets wonderful, and I'm there with a few other photographers. The same is true in Yosemite and every place you go. Dawn, of course, you can usually be there by yourself on any day. But this is the best time of year for dawn, right? It's later and later. I'd like to skim through a couple of things that are on this quote handout by way of introduction. Last paragraph of A.D. Coleman here, it's the big paragraph as the source. No matter how spontaneously, thoughtlessly, or even ineptly we make our photographs, they encode a tremendous amount of information about us, our idiosyncratic personal elements, and of course, revelations of our culture. And that's one of the things about nature photography that is very exciting to me, and I encourage you to start thinking about it. What types of images in nature do we like, and what types of images get published, and what does that say about our present culture? And of course, if you look at most of them, they're all pristine, they're untrammeled by human hand or foot. And that's what wilderness is all about. Just up the road here a piece. The impact of humans in many photos is also quite obvious in nature. The other thing that Ansel Adams points out in this first quote, there are always two people in every photograph. That's you, the photographer, and some audience. I strongly encourage you as a photographer to stop shooting just for yourself all the time. Think about an audience. Who's going to be looking at these photos and how would they interpret this photo? Have you ever been to one of those art classes where someone stands up and talks about a painting or a photograph that they personally did, and all they talk about is what it means to them, and you don't see any of that in the photo or painting? Well, that's what I'm talking about. I think photos should communicate to others, not necessarily just be a personal experience to yourself. And what I'm really saying here is that composition, style, and cropping has impact on viewers. Not on you, because you're making the photo. But you need to combine these elements into the impact on a viewer. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
Here's the question. Cropping to me is something that you do after you've got the negative and you're projecting it and you choose to expose the film to only
right.
one portion of the negative. Is that what we
said? Right.
Rather than doing the cropping, quote unquote, at the time you frame your picture.
That's a good definition of it. And what I want to say today is, especially with color slides, but even with color prints, you will have much more impact if you crop in the camera. And those of you who have heard me earlier say, most people compose reasonably well, but they forget the cropping part, which means, in general, rule number one of composition, compose, and then take about a step or two closer. Fill the frame. It will change the impact of your photo a lot. Fill the frame, unify, simplify, and generally, by filling the frame in some fashion, look around the edges. And of course, with color slides, you can't really crop except by aluminum tape, which you paste around the edge.
Or electrician's tape on
right,
both sides.
Right. And so it's generally best. There's a second very important reason to crop, even with black and white, where you know you can enlarge, right, and do all sorts of cropping. The more you have to blow up a print, in other words, if the best part of the photo is just a sub-element of the negative, and you blow that up, it gets grainy. So the tighter the cropping, the better. So that was a timely point. And again, that brings out the point that you are making the photograph. One or two last comments here. Landscape photography is one of the most difficult things, because unlike taking one of your friends or family and moving them around and composing them for the perfect scene, landscape photography is a very, very volatile experience. Sunday, Sydney and I walked down this little nature trail down here, and these wonderful mushrooms were reddish orange. The next day, Carl and Gibb and I went down there and it faded to a brown. I went back twice, the second time with my camera on Sunday, for the very reason that you must be ready. You have to get out there, you have to do it, and you need your camera, and of course enough film. We've all had the experience, right, of going for a hike and then discovering you're on exposure 34 out of 36 or 22 out of 24. And no more film with it. Light, though, as Adam suggests here, and landscape, you need that combination of earth, sky, cloud, flower blooming. Up at Holden Lake yesterday, Hillary and I were walking past, and she had never seen this one type of flower before. And of course, in the shade, it closes up. So she still hasn't seen it. All right. But that's the type of photography problem that we face. I mean, the moment that you're seeing that. The moment when the light is most eloquent. I love that expression. And there are times of day, early and late, or after storms, before storms, or just during storms, when it is most eloquent. I can't wait sometime this week or next for a rainstorm, because the light will become eloquent. It'll become excellent.
Why?
Because of the diffusion And the cleansing of the sky, for one thing, of course, with rain, but just that extra cloud cover and the sparklingness of the white as it comes through the clouds or after the storm, that's the time to shoot. And of course, you then have water beating on many things too.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that for the effect?
Right. Another little effect, by the way, that many nature photographers use is a little spritzer bottle, yeah, and it works. It will really liven up flowers and so on. I personally don't use that, but many images that you see, that's a result of that. Now, on the bottom of the handout of Depth of Field are my references to composition. So if you don't have that or want another copy of that, you're welcome to pass the extra one around there. Let's start then with the idea of composition. And by the way, what I thought we'd do is talk about an hour, and then your seed of knowledge will definitely be numb. So we'll go out and work on some composition in the field. You could either sketch some composition ideas on your paper, or if you have your cameras with you. And what we'll do is go in different types of light to two or three different scenes that I found very close here. So don't be afraid, it's not a long walk. So that'll be our second hour. That should take us to about four, when I know some people have to do. All right, so let's deal with, again, we've defined cropping. And the recommendation is definitely do it in the camera for those two reasons. One, create impact, especially in your color slides or prints. And by the way, most cameras with color slides or prints have a little tiny edge of the actual negative that doesn't show in your viewfinder. So if you look back through your old work and you see little things kind of stick in, bright sticks or little objects that you didn't think was in there, there's just like a little 16th of an inch of the negative that you don't actually see. Another reason to step in closer.
To go forward, yeah.
Right. So always move in tighter. That is another reason that I encourage people to think about zoom lenses, because also zoom lenses allow you to change the composition and move in tighter without physically having to move. And sometimes you literally can't get any closer to an object.
I learned one in reverse marking the first time I heard about it. I took some pictures on a tour, and invariably, if I think I've got something I want to make prints of, the next thing I'll do is I'll get a 5x7 and see how it looks in a 5x7. Well, the scene I was taking happened to be a metal logging tower fully extended, and first I framed the picture so that I got the full tower and the lines and the whole deal. Went through my shots and said, I want 5x7s, this and this and this. Got the 5x7, looked back, guess what?
Right.
Top of the tower was right. I said, what is this? I said, Tim, what is this? Look at my film, the tower's there. I said, how come you did that? He says, they cropped it into production. They take off 6%.
Exactly. Well, that's only for
5x7s. For 5x7s.
Right.
I said, what do I do? I want to give a gentleman an 8x10. I said, are they going to crop the top of this thing? He said, order 8x12.
Right. You have to deal and remember, as you were just describing, all of you, in the future with prints, you have to remember that you're dealing with a 3x5 ratio, which is 6x10, 9x15. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And if your prints aren't going to be that, then you have to deal with different ratios inside the negative.
Well, I never heard of that, but right. when I compose, or when we take pictures with the 35 lens, very often I just crowd my lens for all it's worth trying to get a picture in, see?
Now, that's an important factor to consider, and one worth bringing up here. Go to the photo store sometime and ask them to look at their plastic cropping sheet and then hold it over your negative, and you can see the shapes, the ratios. You better make your own. And certainly enlarging, you can see that too.
What were you talking about a couple days ago about zoom lenses and how they
We'll look at that.
Okay.
Soon. We're switching to slides here in just a second. Style then becomes, as I said, something you should do. If you're not aware of it, in nature photography, there's a big, big criticism of derivative photos. That means you're using the same spot on the ground that someone else took, right? And or having your tripod holes in someone else's tripod holes before. And people claim that you're stealing work. But light is always different. The moment is different. And ultimately, you will tell us a lot about you through even the same photo of Half Dome or whatever. You can't be Ansel Adams. You can't be somebody else. But it's worth practicing. But
ultimately, it's called derivative photos.
Yeah. Ed Cooper is one of the people that was accused of that years ago. He's now into spirituality and the inner self. He's given up photography. Anyway, composition, though, by definition, in that first paragraph of number 4, one definition says it's the collection of elements in the picture. In other words, you collect elements. And as we've learned this week, or if you haven't been here, depth of field, choice of lens, and of course camera angle all enter into that collecting process. You can get rid of some things through depth of field. Oh, and shutter speed, of course. I left that out. Because if something's moving fast, you can either choose to freeze it or let it blur and not be in the scene. Lastly, all of these things compete for viewers' attention. So let's move on to composition then, the slides. Let me say, as I look at this very bright collection of curtains over here, that when you look at a scene and start working on composition, the brightest thing in that scene will attract the viewer's eye first. So I just use this as an analogy. Your eye will always go to the brightest element in the photo, even if it's terribly out of focus. So that's one thing to start practicing with in terms of eye view. There we go. Anybody know where these lights?
Yeah, they're out in the hall.
Out in the hall. Jonathan, would you turn the slides on, please? Earlier we talked about perspective, and that's the second element then beyond of composition, beyond this brightest element, which was just a fortuitous analogy to the curtain. Perspective is everything, and of course it's pretty difficult to get out here and look back on Earth. However, if you look at a lot of nature photography in the last decade, we have seen an enormous effort to break through the cliché, to work on new kinds of perspective. And of course, the aerial photograph in the last decade has now almost become the new cliché. My point is this, and you've heard this before, some of you, avoid eye level perspective, especially with your 50 millimeter lens, because it ultimately becomes boring, dull. If you're using an automatic camera, those of you who happen to have one, that's what you do all the time. You just sit there, and we do it as a group. We sit there, eye level, snap. But with the 50 millimeter lens, which is considered a normal lens, you also are making the objects what you think appear to be the same size as your eye, but in fact they end up being too small. with a 50 millimeter lens.
That's 50 millimeters, sometimes called wide angle?
No, the wide angle will be anything 35 millimeter or smaller. So that's an excellent question. Wide angle 35 or less, normal for 50, and telephoto starts about 135. Something I encourage, by the way, if you're purchasing lens, try to do it in triples. Do a like a 24 or 28, double or triple it to 50, double that to, or you see what I'm saying, up to 135. Though a zoom lens will provide you some of that in between. So with that 50 millimeter lens, step closer. Always step closer with your normal lens. If that's the only lens you have, the best thing you can do is fill the frame a little bit more. Unless you have that framing issue that we just talked about. All right, a couple other composition ideas. Believe it or not, this is in the Muir Wilderness in the Sierra Nevada, not the Southwest. All right, that's the snowbank down there. And I'm looking at this, I'm struggling with the light. It's getting too bright. It's dawn. Notice how the sky is already washing out a little bit. It's losing its tan. Another technique of composition that I think works wonders with color photography is to switch perspective. Backlight. Okay. And of course we have the corollary that in this particular case goes along with that. Composition using a silhouette. See what I've done? Where did I meter?
On the sky.
On the sky, letting the rock arch go totally black. And in fact, I bracketed by underexposing just a little to make sure that rock would be black.
I'd like to pick up on something you said about the sky.
Any comments? Yeah.
Then the sky, if you will, is purest. First in the morning, at dawn, at dusk.
Right, it's the reddest at dawn and at dusk.
I guess what I mean is it best for photographs at dawn, at dusk, in terms of anywhere from 10 o'clock until 4 in the afternoon?
What I see between 10 and 4, most people say, is that it burns out the highlights. It's flatter. But it's contrastier, too. This, however, this type of light is very contrasty because, you can get silhouettes in morning and at night much easier. Backlighting, though, will also allow you to do much more intense color work in the middle of the day. So if you are out there between 10 and 4 p.m., do backlighting. This is not an example of that. So, this is in Zion National Park. You have to scramble off the highway a little bit, just a little bit. And there is this marvelous, marvelous scene. And by the way, another composition idea that you will see lots of nature photographers doing, look how little sky is in the scene. That's because the sky exceeds the film latitude. In other words, you can't get the sky exposed properly and the rest of the scene. So you're forced to switch in your composition ideas between one or the other. Now remember what I then told you. This is probably a 35 millimeter, slight wide angle, all right? And I'm looking at the scene and I'm saying to myself, how many times have you told your students that the camera works perfectly fine in a vertical? So I put the zoom lens on, 80 to 200, exactly the same scene, moved in on those vertical slick rock, and what's the telephoto do, Jonathan? You raised the question just a minute ago. The telephoto compresses front to back. It stacks up those little waves in the rock. It compresses it. We'll see some more examples of this. So anything over 80 millimeters in a focal length will start compressing a little bit. The other side of the coin is a wide angle, especially 28, 24, and so on. Distort slightly, we'll start bending, and we'll see those at the very end.
Well, wouldn't you also on something like that use your horizontal because your texture is horizontal and you want to emphasize the texture?
Well, that was my original point. And then I just thought to myself, but what if the magazine editor or the calendar editor wants to run a vertical? Mm-hmm. Or if in my slideshow or whatever, suddenly I need a vertical. And in fact, what with this photograph, it becomes more of a, I mean, I forced those things to become vertical almost using that telephoto. Now, I've just revealed something about my style. I'm thinking as my audience, a magazine or calendar editor, and they buy, frankly, the majority of shots are vertical. Mm-hmm. So you know what I do? I go out and I shoot a horizontal, and I shoot a vertical in most cases where I have something this wonderful. So we'll come back. Now this is not my shot. I'll always tell you when that's a great shot like this. By the way, there's the secret to shooting reptiles. You put them in cool water and you slow their body movements down. They also, or the refrigerator, it also works for children, but they tend to complain. All right, we're switching to a new concept here, and it's called the rule of thirds. I suspect many of you have heard about this. We have a 3x5 ratio, right? And if you divide either a horizontal or a vertical into thirds, you can see where the circles intersect. Where is the frog's eye? In one of those intersections. Mm-hmm. Where is the alligator's eye?
In
one of the other intersections. Mm-hmm. You look in a museum at ancient, I mean, to us, 300, 400 year old paintings, what were they using? The rule of thirds, consistently. Now, primitive painters, as we've called Grandma Moses and others, tend not to do that. They tend to be more centered or a different style of composition. But the rule of thirds composition is an excellent, excellent tool for us as nature photographers. Consciously avoid centering. That's the best tip of all. Forget the rule of thirds, but just avoid centering your work. There's a technique that I use as a reminder. In the middle right here is the light meter ring, right? That little tiny ring. Well, surrounding that is typically a focusing ring. It's typically built big enough so that if you were to put objects on the outer edge of that focusing ring, you have just put things out in the rule of thirds, PowerPoints as they're called. So the next time you look through your viewfinder, remember this conversation. Ah, rule of thirds, I've got a hint in my viewfinder. And just go for that every time. By the way, there's another classic composition technique here, and that is the diagonal. And of course it refers to the line that this, but look at what depth of field has done to whatever this back here is. It's put it out of focus, either by being close, or by using telephoto lens, or by using a big f-stop number like f2 to fill the background out of focus. Oh, that's too tight. Can we crop this? I don't think this has a zoom in, does it? Ah, there she comes. Thanks. Just leave it that tight. First of all, this is I consider an actively oriented photograph, not just because of the action, not just because of the red shirt, not just because of the rule of thirds idea, but because it has impact. I mean, these two people, it's not my photograph, these two people make me feel good to look at them. It's the kind of moment that I kind of envy and want to experience. But let's go back to the red shirt. It has something to do with the impact of the photograph, right? The rule of thirds has something to do with this photograph. The composition of foreground to background and the lack of depth of field, so that all that background clutter doesn't work. I'm probably done with the telephoto lens. And then, of course, the moment that just passes. I've always wondered if he got wet. By the way, if you want to jump in on any of these, ask or comment, please do. This is one of my pieces I did at a photo workshop as a student down in the Eastern Sierra in the fall. And I'm looking around at different plants of these and think, well, wow, look at that little grass seed. Now that actually violates one of the rules of composition, right? That grass stem, because it's another direction. It ununifies the image. But you've got to break some composition rules. Please do. The second conscious thing that I did was change the perspective to put an aspen in full fall color behind it. And I knew with a telephoto lens, shallow depth of field, that that would provide that lovely glow in the background. Another element of the rule of thirds that people do all the time that creates way too much unease in viewers is to have the horizon line smack dab in the middle. Look at your work. How many horizon lines are smack in the middle? Lake horizons or edges of the lake. What that does, and I can't explain it, but somehow our mind prefers this thirds sense as opposed to a middle half. It's an unconscious process. Psychologists can't really explain it, but just like a centered flower, a horizon that's smack in the middle is not as comfortable. And of course, you could put the horizon line either in the bottom or the top. Now, this marvelous thunderstorm deserves to have the sky as the two-thirds, not cropped tightly at the top. Please do that. Think about that as a rule of thirds element. Horizon lines, or any lines, vertical or horizontal, get them out of the middle.
No.
Now this is not mine, but notice we talked about cropping. This was all the rage about 5 years ago. Every prize-winning photograph, National Geographic photograph, Life magazine photograph, had cropped even tighter horizontal than what the 3x5 aspect gives. Notice the rule of thirds off there with the vehicle down to the right in terms of PowerPoint, and then this great horizon rule of thirds here, though it's almost a quarter. And then what lens was used to flatten this dune to make it look steep like that?
Telephoto
lens. And of course, fast enough shutter speed so you didn't get a blur. There's a shot I used to illustrate the flower centering, the uncentering of the flower. Get it out of the center, move it to one of those PowerPoints. In this case, we've got more than one image. It's just much more psychological pleasing. A nice telephoto shot where I looked at this early morning photographer out there and I just said, ah, remember the little focusing ring and put the photographer out there. There's another composition element, by the way, that if you have someone looking into a scene, don't put them in the center or over on this side looking this way, right? Always give them plenty of room to look into. And again, that's a psychological reaction to a scene, that rule can be broken very nicely. That's a standard rule, though. Here again, we have the classic silhouette technique. And the reason you have a silhouette is that the light meter reading off the subject is way different from the light meter reading off that sunset, almost sunset mountain in the west. However, with the use of selective focus, where does your mind, or where does your eye go first?
The silhouette.
The sharpest, the most, let me say, the best focus, meaning the sharpest focus, again, your eye will go to that first. And it's just a psychological phenomenon again. Somehow our brain and eyes and mind all work into that. It's a technique, by the way, that is not widely used, and I encourage you to experiment with it, because the type of image like that will sell. It's a very popular with markets where they actually have people in them. The reason they like it is they don't have to worry about model releases, because you can't tell who it is. Oh, this one was supposed to be earlier. Remember that thundercloud with the rule of thirds? Well, here's a classic example of what not to do with a variety of things. What have we got? Evenly divided, 50% down, 50% up.
Is that on the Yukon?
No, this is at the Redwood National Park, Prairie Creek. Look at the edge of the photograph. What have we got over here?
Stuff.
Yeah.
It's contributing nothing. It's stuff I didn't see when I shot it. And ultimately, in terms of the animals, pretty good rear end views of them, and that's not generally what wildlife people want to look at. That's just an edge. And look at the clutter in the background, the RVs. Sure, it says this is what the place is, but it's eye level. I mean, it really did. It's kind of a boring shot to me, because I've seen it so much. So you switch perspective, you use the rule of thirds. You allow depth of field to interact with the scene. You provide a foreground to background, and this is the next major composition rule that I would strongly encourage you. Even though it's difficult because of such shallow depth of field, a photograph is essentially a two-dimensional object, right? This book cover, it's just got width and it's got height. But somehow it looks three-dimensional because we've been able to interpret it. They tell me with primitive people, and I've tried it with Anders as a child, and he sees images like this sometimes as flat, two-dimensional things. He can't recognize what the object is. We learn to interpret what a photo is in three dimensions. Well, here's an example up here of where you can force three dimensions on a subject. You have to use a red cup, of course, or a red chair. The National Outdoor Leadership School. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I taught a backpacking photo course there 3-4 years. The only thing I'd do differently is see that cup there and get that one bird. And a rainbow in there. This is not mine, and it also shows the power of black and white. Jonathan's going to be doing some black and white, he tells me, so inspiration here. The next idea, rule of thirds, look at that cat, right? And the window, it's over in the rule of thirds. And then we have the lines that provide some sense of movement, some sense of power. Here's a beautiful example that, again, it's almost a circle within the photograph of lines. Your eye can pick out lines in nature very, very well once you start looking for them. Again, up in the Sierra Nevada, looking west at the sunset, I'm looking at the color and all this, and all of a sudden I realize, wait a minute, look at that curve. That gives that scene much more three dimension because of the cloud curve than anything else. Rule of thirds as well. This is not mine either, but oh, super wide, you know, like 24 millimeter wide angle, giving lots of depth of field. Backlighting, so you get the silhouette. And then rule of thirds and line for depth. To me, that contains all of the elements of a photograph in terms of composition. Also not mine. But as I say, nature and the nautilus shell, the spiral of line, well, there are other objects as well as other things in nature that create a similar spiral. This is inside a hot air balloon, by the way, if you're not...
Inside?
Inside, right. Mm-hmm.
I can get perspective on that.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to figure out what's going on.
I thought it was a parachute this way to be.
No, it's the inside of the hot air balloon.
Oh, that's.
And again, back to the diagonal. First of all, you find something red. These wild roses, rose hips. And then I'm looking at the diagonal of the branch. And guess what I had to live with? That pipe in the background. I figured, well, I'll minimize depth of field, and we'll just see how it looks. And ultimately, maybe you could make a statement, nature and human impact. But it's the diagonal. Use the diagonal.
Where's the pipe?
It's this.
Black with yellow line.
This.
Oh.
That kid's
here. See it.
It looks like just a big leaf kind of hanging.
Right.
The black kind of washes itself out.
There's something about a diagonal, though, in composition that stimulates activeness in your brain. And who knows, maybe even endomorphins are released with a diagonal. But somehow we get excited about looking at diagonals. It's almost every sports shot has a diagonal through. They even tilt the cropping to create diagonal. Again, not mine. Notice the tighter cropping. Which lens was used here, by the way? To compress that foreground background?
Telephoto. What are the vertical comms?
Those are piers. And of course, with the surfing, if you're really macho, you surf through the piers. But what have we got here? Rule of thirds. If you're really macho and do it, you could be dead, by the way. You've got rule of thirds. You've got a moment. See that moment? I mean, these two people relating to each other in a way, a portrait. But you've got an environment that you have manipulated using that telephoto lens. And then whatever was on this side or that side, you've cropped out. And in terms of light meter reading, the brightest object is the pier. So what the photographer obviously did was meter off the pier and just hope for the best that the rest of it would be in there, because the pier is not overexposed. It's pretty clear. More lines in nature. Of course, unfortunately, we've got plenty of artificial lines, but they work. In Yosemite, slick rock coming down that granite, little drips of water. By the way, I metered off the sky and then underexposed about 2 or 2.5 stops. Because I didn't want the sky. What I wanted was a visible piece of detail in those reflections off the rock. So you meter off the sky and the rock and you go, whoa, that's really bright. So you keep underexposing. I probably shot 3 different shots, and turned out the most underexposed one was this. And what does it combine? It combines the diagonal plus just looking at lines, repeating. You can also look for shapes. This is actually a black and white photograph in color. These are basalt columns, one of the things that nature provides in volcanoes. And then I looked at this plant growing here and I said, well, let's see. You wouldn't be able to pick it out, right, against the bright areas. So you move, put it against a black area for impact. Whoops. All right. There's two photographs here. This is one photograph. Early morning, dew on the image, just enough depth of field, right, to capture the sharpness of the plant. But there's two photographs here. You keep moving in. And notice how the lack of depth of field this close, though, starts to cause you problem in terms of not everything sharp. But that's, to me, what composition and style is all about, and cropping. You look at a scene, and by the way, go ahead and take the first photograph that you thought about. Go ahead and shoot it. But don't go away. Move in tighter. Change to another lens. Change angles. Look around as I did here for a dark background for contrast. And it's just something that you can do on a conscious practice basis. But the key thing is to slow down. What Galen Rowell, who's a well-known mountaineering photographer, does is that he uses a tripod all the time too, or handheld, either one. He says, you take the first photograph and then you treat this little 35 millimeter camera like one of those big box cameras, right? And you slow down and you think about depth of field and you think about focal length and so on. And that's what we're going to do briefly on our hike here, just to illustrate. Reviewing a couple elements then in conclusion. Front lighting, not enough depth of field here. They really aren't sharp everywhere. But against the dark background. By the way, twin competing images like this, it's kind of hard on your eye, isn't it? I mean, your eye bounces back and forth a little bit. But it's a matter of cropping, too. And I said, well, let's lay down on the ground and get under the flower and use backlight. The neat thing about this type of image with backlighting is see how the sunlight provides that little rim of silver. I really think that for me that is much more pleasing. And then forget everything occasionally. Get your lens right in the middle of flowers or whatever and forget about enough depth of field. Just freeze the action so it's not blurred. And then just go for abstract. I used to be a kind of tight person about abstract photography, right? I wanted everything to be sharp and crisp. And then I finally bought this macro lens and I went to a workshop. The guy said, forget those tripods, just stick your lens into the flowers and go for abstracts. And I also read a book by Freeman Patterson on photography. If you're not familiar with his work, he's a Canadian who does incredibly nice abstract work. Freeman Patterson. Again, a reminder, competing images can cause problems, but you go for good light, you go for good moment, you try to get what you can. Silhouettes. You meter off a sky, for example, like this. This is shooting into the morning sky, and then you underexpose so that the tree doesn't show up except as a detail. or accept as the soil. There for a while, I was really stuck on dealing with silhouettes in almost all types of shots. And in this case, it's right down the middle. I think in retrospect, I'd move it off to the right a little bit. But I was dealing with silhouettes as a background, not as a foreground. I really like that. And of course, the standard sunset scene with the sky down through the Grand Canyon and the rocks. I spent two rolls of film, I think, this night trying to get a lightning bolt shot in there too, and didn't succeed. This is a photograph by Ansel Adams referring to texture, which is one of the last elements that we're going to talk about. Texture in a photograph is just like that front to back dimensions. It provides a feel for your brain to interact with. This is backlighting though, which of course will provide texture because you can see the shadow. Ponderosa pine bark. Now, this is not mine. I wish I could find one this colorful.
That's incredible.
Ponderosa.
Looks like a rock formation.
It is. It's just ponderosa pine bark.
What's the white thing on the bottom?
That's the cropping from the magazine.
Oh.
This is a severe telephoto, probably a 500 millimeter lens. See the flamingos? And then they have walked across the sand dune behind this lake bed here. There's the flat, and then the sand dune goes up.
Avalanches from their footprints.
Yeah, and their footprints have caused those little avalanches. But you see, photographs do not have to be real. This is not a real photograph. This is a created photograph. And that's what composition is all about. But it has impact. Because I stopped and I looked at this and I said, what's going on here?
You took that?
No, I don't have a 500. That's
now, I was interested in where the flamingos were, where there was that much sand.
There's a place in Africa. And of course, this is like one of those shots that kind of reverse in. First it's a depression and then it's a... It will kind of bounce back and forth, but it's texture and it's flat light. And of course, with black and white, sometimes you can even get a bigger sense of texture.
Rock climbers.
Yeah. We're almost done here. One of the things with texture that you can also do is look for juxtaposition or contrast. And it's not just texture, it's all photographs. Juxtaposition. Meaning next to each other, right? Or the contrast. And this is one of my favorite photos by Francis Woodruff in the newspaper shot. Isn't that
is great.
That combination is so great. And then, well, again, one of my favorite people portraits. Look at that contrast. That, I mean, we can all relate to the age, and then that untouched child's face. Of course,
even to the texture of the garments, too,
right?
The two of them.
Right. The clothing, everything is there in terms of texture. By the way, in terms of black and white, for those of you who aren't familiar, this is probably a fairly bright, distracting area here, and maybe over there. And what you can do in black and white is burn in or cause this area to become darker. That's the jargon, burning in. And notice, this is not a very sharply focused face when you start to look at it. But does it matter very much?
No.
Not at all. It's the impact of the composition.
Are you using the focus on the left hand?
It's the impact of the composition. And it's symbolic. If you know the Navajo and the Pueblo reservations of our Southwest, it's incredibly symbolic of the different visions of the directions the youth are going from the elder. So there's some hope there. This place called Antelope Canyon, just outside of Page, Utah. I didn't bring my shots of this because I've got them submitted right now to the Sierra Club. But you can go to this place. Any of you can go to this place. It's on the, just to the east of Page, Arizona, and ask about the Corkscrew Canyon area of Antelope Canyon. And if you just look up at this 60 to 100 foot slot, and depending on the time of day, and of course this is cropped square, which 20 and 30 years ago most editors were doing. But boy, what a place to photograph. And of course it's just lines, it's color, it's silhouettes. Incredible place. Texture, everywhere you look. I was just down, if you walk where the trucks are walking, are running down to the stream, right? And then they go down the stream, which is kind of a neat photograph. But walk a little bit past the culverts and turn to the right and look at the tailings.
Striations of the tailings.
It's like a sand dune. All the lightest tailings have blown over to the east edge. And there's, it's like a sand dune striations. And it's a wonderful image about 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it's backlit. You can see the texture. Unfortunately, some people will kind of walk through one edge of it. But you can keep moving in and just do untouched. I want to illustrate a point here. This is with a 200 millimeter lens, so it filled the frame, right? But it's about a half hour after sunset and a 2 second exposure at about f5.6. You can get lots of depth of field, even with a telephoto lens and even at f5.6. There's just enough sharpness there. And of course, what it's also picking up is that great blue, little shininess of the blue, and it's a natural varnish.
Who's it?
It's yucca. Lots of depth of field in this case, and a red shirt.
Who's that, Roskelly or something?
Yeah. I really love the shirt. Of course, he's getting paid to hold those skis that way. This is Evers. Telephoto lens. I love this political statement here. It's slightly distorted because of the copying, but see how it compresses foreground to background?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great technique with a telephoto. And it's a posed shot, which violates some of our photojournalistic ideas, but political statement. This is a shot of the National Geographic down in Humboldt County, a logger in the redwoods. Notice that it's backlit. The sun is behind the subject, so it's not a contrasty scene.
That's the genuine article. It's got his logger's world suspenders on.
Yep. And that, just by fortuitousness or by planning, there's that little sparkle off the helmet. A couple more things from National Geographic that I think are worth looking at. One is the triangle composition. We haven't talked about that yet, but it's rule of thirds here, and then you get a triangle line. And color, again with the triangle. Remember to shoot color. And then people break all the rules. Again, this is a marvelous photograph, I think. Lining her up there with the edge of the building and maybe by accident having someone on a bicycle silhouetted against the wall.
You took these from the National Geographic. Yeah. You have a thing where you flatten them and a couple
right,
of things on the sideline.
Just copy.
You use your macro.
Yeah. I also get copies from the National Press Photographers Association annual competition. Copies of their slide. And by way of closing, let's remember you can always make a political statement with your photograph. This is our friend Mr. Watt, the one-shot antelope hunt. remember, I didn't have these in the last class meeting, but some of you asked about what was that keystoning effect of wide-angle lenses? And I remember with a wide-angle lens, when you have vertical images, notice the tilt off to the right there and the left. Right. Things are this way.
Is this a 28?
This is the only a 35.
Really?
Yeah. But you see, with redwoods, you immediately start this symptom of.
Is that a smattering of snow?
It's snow. It's snow. So actually, a little bit more overexposure would have made it even more white, which might have improved it.
So how do you handle that?
Well, you
turn it vertical.
You try verticals, but see, it's still keystone, and ultimately
but even on that image, right. That's not so far off from what right. You see yourself.
Right, vertical, you can do. And by the way, notice what I forgot to see in the corner of my viewfinder, some more clutter. I think this is the last one. Yeah.
Where do you do those copies and you use your macro? Do you just do the through the lens metering to decide for your reproduction?
Yeah, exposure? But you have to experiment with your. Never.
I didn't have, but I get tired because every time I do it a little differently. And even though I make notes, and you know, the subject matter is sometimes different and then it throws everything off.
Yeah. All I can say is if you do have a copy stand, that run a test roll through because it's going to be different from what your meter actually said. Typically, well, it can either be over or under. I mean, the test will vary. Now, who would like to go for a short walk? I want to go up to the jacuzzi because there's a marvelous image up there first, and then we'll just go down the road here. You want to join me
for
a few minutes and let's work through some images? No, it's not the people in the jacuzzi, it's a plant. What time of day is it? It's 3:03.
We're gonna go on.